Now on Bloomberg 106.1.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody do your job.
And together we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 106.1 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
I'm Tom Maroney.
And I'm Peter Barnes with Pat Carroll.
On tonight's show, violent racist is what Democrats are calling Trump's language a day after his remarks about Haiti and the African nations. We check with our Washington reporter about the fallout and whether Trump's vulgarity has become a deal breaker for any number of deals. Also today, it's bank earnings driving the markets to new heights. As the new year rolls on in high style, Matt Miskin of John Hancock Investments tell us whether he's confident that this record-making equities run will continue.
A deceased loved one leaves behind many things, and today that could include a social media presence and cryptocurrencies. What to do about Grandpa's Facebook page or Grandma's Bitcoins? Fidelity Wealth Management Executive Kevin Ruth walks us through the options.
On the line right now is our Supreme Court reporter, Greg Storr, who's done a great job through the years. Greg, we're talking about late word that the U.S. Supreme Court will consider freeing state and local governments to collect billions in these sales taxes from online retailers. Let's take our listeners back to 1992. Quill versus North Dakota, the court said, if the company doesn't have a physical presence in the state, you can't collect the taxes. The Supremes will hear arguments against that. Tell us how this came about, first of all.
Well, it came about because South Dakota wanted to overturn that Quill ruling. They passed a law that they knew would be unconstitutional under that ruling, and basically invited a court fight, and then asked the Supreme Court to take up the case and consider overturning it so that they can impose those taxes.
And we want to point out that this was a case that involved Boston's own Wayfair, huge online home furnishings retailer. This is South Dakota versus Wayfair. Greg, what kind of money are we talking about here? What are the states not getting?
So the best estimate that we are finding is one that comes out of the Government Accountability Office that says up to about $13 billion more states and local governments could have collected had they been allowed to require online retailers to collect sales taxes. There are some estimates that are even higher than that. All but five states impose sales taxes, so it's a pretty broad coverage in terms of the impact.
So, Greg, it always struck me when we've talked about this through the years in various ways. How do you go about enforcing this? Because if I buy something online, I'm not running off to tell the state where I purchased this or the state I'm in.
Yeah, so right now you are still, if you buy something in South Dakota right now and the retailer doesn't collect the tax from you, you are supposed to pay it, but you're right, it's very easy not to. What the Supreme Court could do is say that states now have the ability to force the retailer to collect that from you, whether or not they have a physical presence in the state. So you would no longer have that way to essentially avoid paying.
But Greg, how are they going to know?
Well, they know it through the retailer. So the retailer is the one that they would tax. They don't know that you made the individual purchase, but they have the ability to require the retailer to say at the end of the year, here's how much money we have collected through our sales in your state.
The retailers don't want to do this, right?
It varies a little bit. So Amazon, which of course is the biggest one, actually does collect tax now in every state, in part because they kept setting up warehouses and having physical presences in states, and they couldn't avoid it. But they would like a kind of a national system. They would like Congress to be involved so that they don't have to deal with all these different states. Other retailers like Wayfair, Overstock, only collect taxes from customers in some states. So they would be more directly affected. And finally, third parties who sell their items through Amazon don't always collect that sales tax, so they would be affected.
Yeah, all right. Well, Greg Storr, we are going to certainly keep an eye on this. As Peter Barnes says, Wayfair is involved. In your story today, you also list Overstock and Newegg, and I know my wife just bought something from Overstock, so I'll go home and make sure we're compliant. Anyway, coming up, we are going to talk about bank earnings driving the markets to new heights today, but it could, on another day, it could be another factor. As the new year rolls on in high style, Matt Miskin of John Hancock Investments is here. He's a strategist to tell us whether he is confident this record-making equities run will continue. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business. Bloomberg 1061, Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West on the South Shore. The last 24 hours or so, or less, have been consumed by what people are calling the President Trump's vile remarks about Haiti and the African nations. We want to know what the fallout is. So on the line right now is our congressional reporter, live from the Hill in D.C., Laura Litvan. Laura, welcome to our program. I want to start with a general question. You know, when Trump says these things, the conventional wisdom says, oh, the base is cheering and everybody else is just walking away, shaking their head. In other words, nothing really changes. Does this news cycle with these remarks, as far as you can tell, change any of the political equation in Washington?
Well, it comes at a very inopportune time because the Democrats in Congress hold a lot of the cards that will potentially keep us from having a government shutdown or having one. They have enough votes in the Senate that their votes are needed for a spending deal or even a short-term stopgap measure next Friday, and they're insisting on an immigration deal of some kind, and the president's comments added to an already tense situation. He already had been rejecting, in the same meeting where he made his remarks, a bipartisan deal that Democrats had hoped leaders in both parties would agree to simply tuck inside the spending bill so they can get through the Republican House, where many hardline immigration Republicans would perhaps vote against it.
And Laura, you know, the president tweeted first thing this morning, the language used by me in the DACA meeting, this meeting at the White House we're talking about, was tough, but this was not the language used. He denied using the language. What have you learned from your sources on the Hill who were at the meeting?
Well, we've learned, even yesterday evening, we had three sources confirming for us that they had, that he had made these remarks. And then Dick Durbin this morning, to reporters in Chicago when he was heading back to his home state of Illinois, he publicly confirmed them and walked through the conversation. And he then later in the day, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, a Republican who's been working on a bipartisan deal with Dick Durbin and other senators, said, without stating what the president had said, said that he had come back to the president in the meeting and effectively had rebuked him or, you know, came back at these remarks that he'd made. We also had two Republican senators, immigration hardliners, Tom Cotton and David Perdue, who are at the meeting, who say they don't recall these comments. When I asked their office if that meant they were saying the other lawmakers were lying, they simply pointed back to this, the statement that they didn't recall the comments.
And Lindsey Graham has said, I spoke my mind to the president, and I believe I read reports that he basically told him off inside that meeting, but he won't say that in public.
Yes, he seems to be very careful, and in fact, yesterday, coming back to the Capitol from that meeting, he did not disclose these initially. He was commenting just simply about his hopes that the bipartisan deal would somehow live on and they would continue negotiations and make some changes, which I think that all sides are probably going to make some attempt at next week.
How threatening is this to any kind of a deal on immigration and not closing down the government? You say the Democrats have some power here. What will they do with that?
Well, the real question is whether they would really take this over the line to a shutdown. The Republicans, the leaders in both chambers, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, are saying these are separate issues. We're debating a spending bill, and we're probably going to have a stopgap measure next Friday. And then that's separate from immigration. The Democrats are saying, you know, our votes are needed, especially in the Senate, to get this through, and that's what we want. And in December, when this issue was also part of negotiations, in the Senate, many of the Democratic senators who were on the ballot in November, who come from Trump states, were not eager to have a shutdown and went ahead and helped push through a stopgap measure. And that's what Republicans are hoping will happen again.
Laura Litvin is a congressional correspondent for Bloomberg News. And Laura, when we were talking about this earlier, you suggested at one point that the risk here is for the Democrats. On the one hand, they risk angering fellow Democrats and Democratic voters if they don't stand up to the president on this. But on the other hand, they don't want to be responsible for a government shutdown. That, you know, that's been proven to be bad politics. So talk about that.
Well, it's bad politics on both sides because the Republicans have the House and the Senate and the White House, so they're not eager for this either. But, you know, some of those Democratic senators who are from Trump-won states, such as Joe Manchin from West Virginia or Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, they're from states that don't have a high population of these young undocumented immigrants that the party wants to help, and they're really trying to kind of side... Don't want to part ways with the president too often, and at least in December, this wasn't really a fight they wanted to have.
All right, Laura Litvin, I know you're going to keep an eye on this for us, and we will continue to monitor as well those events in Washington vis-a-vis Trump's remarks. I mean, maybe tomorrow there'll be another tweet that everybody will be talking about. So I'm not sure how much difference this makes, but yeah, we have to talk about it. So coming up, last I looked, Dow Jones had a very nice day today. I guess you could say that for a lot of days that we've been looking at here. And so we're going to check in with a specialist, Matt Miskin of John Hancock Investments. He's going to tell us how confident he is on this ride that the equities market has been taking. We've been asking people, and we'll ask him. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business, Bloomberg 1061, Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 1061 Boston Newburyport and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.
I'm Peter Barnes with Tom Maroney and Pat Carroll. To the markets, bank earnings driving the markets to new highs again today, but Matt Miskin, market strategist for John Hancock Investments, gets paid to worry. He's a little worried about the U.S. equity performance compared to international stocks, as well as a little bit about China and the yield curve. He joins us now with more. And Matt, you're calling for a pullback in U.S. equities this year. How much and how should investors prepare?
Well, we just came off of a year of exceptionally low volatility. And I think as an investor, the first thing to do is just to realize that that is the exception, not the rule. We saw a 3% drawdown. That's if you pick the worst day to invest last year, the most you lost before making your money back was 3%. Not too bad, right? The average over the last 20 years is about a 12% drawdown. So your peak to trough, you've lost about 12% before making your money back. We would not be surprised to see something along those lines over the course of the year. The yield curve is what we're watching in particular, but there's other things at play certainly for volatility in 2018.
Well, Matt, you know, I want to talk a little bit about the good news here. BlackRock certainly had a good day. JP Morgan, Wells all reported Q4 earnings this morning. How much of this, I don't know what you call it, exuberance, frothiness, how much of that is due to the tax plan? Because we hear these businesses doling out bonuses. We hear businesses, oh, we're so happy about things. And we've even had people on this program who talk about that. What's your take?
Earnings estimates. So there's analysts out there that cover these companies, and they come out with what they think these companies are going to earn. Right. Well, over the last 2 weeks, earnings estimates have gone up 20% for 2018 earnings. That's an incredible catch-up for earnings. And if you look at financials in particular, they've gone up 50% in 2 weeks. So analysts are waking up to this tax plan, and it is real.
That's a big jump, my friend.
It is. That's earnings. We think this tax plan is all about earnings, and stocks follow earnings. If you can simple it down in investing in equities, mm-hmm. stocks follow earnings. We think that is going to be conducive. Doesn't mean stocks can't go down. But overall, over the next year or two, we think they end higher because earnings growth is there.
And another record day, of course, today, and partly because of optimism with retail sales.
Yeah, the retail sales number was pretty good, about 5.6% year over year in terms of retail sales. The home furnishing and home improvement side looked exceptionally well. We think that's a big story as we go into 2018. And the consumer looks good. Surveys continue to be pretty positive. That tends to be a bit of a leading indicator in terms of retail spending. And we think that continues into the next year.
So back to the stuff that you get paid to worry about and what keeps you up at night. A couple points here. You think that actually now international may do better than U.S. this year. You are worried about China slowing. You already mentioned the yield curve, but you specifically talked about the Fed. There's a lot to click through there, but go ahead and touch on those things.
Yeah, so overall, we think that international might surprise and outperform next year. And the reason why is, one, because the valuations are more attractive. They're trading at about a 25% discount to that of the United States. The long-term average is about 8. So there's a big valuation wedge there. We think that could catch up. If you think about risks out there, and you do think about China is trying to manage a slowdown. They put the foot on the gas last year and the year before, but now they're trying to manage to slow that a bit. There's going to be ripple effects across asset classes as a result of that. Our base case is there's no significant slowdown in China, but even a modest slowdown can have implications across asset classes.
You know, since you brought up China, we had a story earlier this week that China was put a slowdown on U.S. treasuries. I don't know if you caught any of that. This is a Bloomberg scoop. And then the Chinese government said a day later, no. What do you make of all that?
In our view, China's not trying to manage their international debt holdings like a bond portfolio manager. They are likely managing their currency to a band. And that is usually through buying and selling of sovereign bonds around the world. It's unlikely that they're going to be that outright in trying to communicate their strategy in terms of buying and selling securities. Nonetheless, you know, if you look at the data, they've accumulated a lot of treasuries over the years. They're slowly tapering that. The dollar weakened a bit here, so selling doesn't make it sounds about right. But we wouldn't jump to conclusions either way. Managing a fixed income portfolio, our managers aren't overreacting to that news. They're sticking to their strategy and managing accordingly.
What about the Fed? Do you think they're on track for the 2 to 3 rate hikes they've penciled in? And could resurging inflation possibly knock that forecast off? Or could the Fed end up going slower?
You know, our base case is that 2 sounds about right, but 3 is definitely in the cards, potentially in the cards. And the reason why we say that, I mean, CPI came out this morning, so that's a inflation reading.
And it was stronger than expected. The core was
exactly
1.8.
Exactly,
1.7 was the expectation.
Yep. Yeah. So the core, and that's what they're looking at. They're trying to strip out the more noisy, food and energy components, and look at the core. 1.8. Their target's 2. That's not that far off. Now, core PCE is really what they look at. That's still at 1.5, so that, it's a little bit behind that. Nonetheless, there's certainly housing was the biggest inflationary driver, and then healthcare costs. Food prices remain pretty subdued, so that's a part that's not blowing away inflation, but housing and healthcare continue to drive inflation. If that continues, they could get 3 rate hikes in 2018, and we don't think
that's baked in, right? I mean, investors are expecting that. It says if they were to do 4, for example, get a little more aggressive, that might not knock things off track here. But Pat, go ahead.
Well, finally, you had mentioned the risk of the potential for the inverted yield curve. What do you think of that possibility?
If you do the math here, so if the Fed does raise rates 3 more times, that's 3 25 basis point moves. We're at 1.5 on the Fed funds rate. That gets you to 225. You add about 30 basis points to the 2-year because that's the spread it usually trades at. We're at 255. The 10-year today, I think at closing, is about 255. That's pretty darn close. So that's not a lot of breathing room before we get an inverted yield curve. And the reason why we think that's important, it's of the best signals of a forthcoming recession. And we're keeping close eye on that in the next year.
All right. Matt Miskin, market strategist for John Hancock Investments. Keep worrying, and thanks for joining us.
He doesn't look too worried.
Yeah, he doesn't look too worried. All right. Well, coming up, a deceased loved one leaves behind many things, and today that could be a social media presence and cryptocurrencies. What do you do about Grandpa's Facebook page or Grandma's Bitcoins? Fidelity Wealth Management Executive Kevin Ruth will walk us through the options. All that coming up on Bloomberg Bay State Business, 106.1 Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. Going to pivot to estate planning in the age of social media and Bitcoin. Fidelity Investments is pushing clients to pay closer attention to digital assets and has some tips for keeping track of them to help heirs. Kevin Ruth is the head of wealth planning and personal trust at Fidelity, and he joins us now by phone. Kevin, obviously Fidelity felt it was important to start raising this issue with clients. So how important is it becoming with people? Have people been not paying attention to it? And this is all happening as now actually you have, you know, digital assets like cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, Tom. Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on the show. So it's something that we first noticed when we started having clients go paperless, right? And when most firms want to have clients be paperless, it's good for the economy. It's less expensive. And when you go then to help a family settle their estate, there's no more filing cabinet. There's no more drawer to go in to kind of get those statements or those records. And so we realized that there was a real issue with accessing people's bank accounts online in order to get their financial information after someone passed away. And the natural extension to that was, well, what about their other digital assets? What about, not only purchasing a Bitcoin or other type of cryptocurrency, but what about their Facebook account, their Instagram account, iTunes, Dropbox? What happens to the accounts after someone passes away? And that's what got us to focus on it.
Well, Kevin, you know, this brings up, I don't know the answer to this question, but I always assumed, you know, if a loved one passed away and I wanted to get into their Facebook account, I'd contact Facebook. That's not the case though, right? Or I'd contact Instagram or...
Yeah, you could contact Facebook or Instagram, but, you know, there are consumer protection laws and there are privacy laws that don't allow those companies to actually interact with you. And unless it's explicit in your legal documents, your will or your revocable trust or any other type of legal document you have that gives someone permission to actually access those accounts and have a right to your passwords, those firms are not legally allowed to provide that information to you. And so then what you end up have to do is spend a lot of money and go to court to try to get access to those accounts.
Just a quick follow-up on that. If I'm the executor, for instance, does that give me the power?
It doesn't. It's going to give you the power to talk to them, but they're going to need to know explicitly that there's someone who can get that can give access into that account, and you want to do that in your will by explicitly listing out that person.
Interesting.
Huh. I did not know that. You know, I was actually because you posted an article on this online at Fidelity.com on your Viewpoints page, and I did learn a lot. In this article, including what is financially valuable in the digital world, and then aside from the sentimental thing. So obviously virtual currencies are one of them, but then you had these other things, personal or professional blogs that provide advertising revenue, domain names. I hadn't thought about it. I have, you know, Peter Barnes is a great radio host.com. Which, you know, I monetize.
Oh, hold on.
Heck out of, and I forgot about that. So thank you. Thank you for the reminder. But then also other revenue generating digital things like that as well. And I hadn't even thought about those things.
It seems
if you think about it, it's when we think of our assets, we're in a digital age, but we haven't been thinking about digital assets, and that's why we thought it was so important to focus on it. A lot of these other firms, though, are doing the same thing. So, like Facebook now actually has an ability for you as one of their enhancements of naming a legacy contact. So, if something happens to you and the executor does contact Facebook, if you've named a legacy contact in as part of your account in Facebook, they will actually then allow that person to interact and actually decide if they want to shut down your Facebook account or actually memorialize it. And you can actually keep it up there post-death if that's what the legacy contact decides to do.
it isn't enough to just share with your spouse or your nearest and dearest all of your passwords and all that, which is really the way
exactly
we've been going.
What we recommend. Yeah, no,
it's
that's
not enough.
We recommend as a first step is to actually make that list, because that's what most people don't have, right? If you think about it, we've been really programmed kind of our whole lives now to actually not share a password with anybody, don't write it down, make sure it's in a secure place. And then when you pass away, it's exactly when your family and the people that are going to take care of your estate need to get that information. So we actually strongly recommend that you do make a list of your digital assets, actually with your usernames, with your passwords, where to find this information, and then to store it either with your legal documents or, there are many digital sites that you can actually, protect your web, your passwords or password protected applications.
Kevin Ruth is our guest. He's head of wealth planning and personal trust at Fidelity. He's on the line now at Bay State Business. Kevin, this sounds more like lawyer work than work that's done at Fidelity. I mean, what's in it for Fidelity to take this on?
I think if you look at what Fidelity does, there's a lot of things that we do that we don't actually charge our clients for. FidSafe is a perfect example where we actually have a digital storage site where it's not only free to Fidelity customers, but it's actually free to anyone who wants to use it, because we just know that we're in a digital age now. We know the importance of it. And so for us, it's about making sure that our clients are protected, making sure that they have they're able to make good decisions, and really educating them on this new area.
Can I ask, are there any things that we should be watching with your physical assets because of the rise of, online trading and all these other things? I mean, you still own stocks, bonds, real estate, but a lot of that stuff has gone digital as well.
That's exactly right, and that's why, again, as we really started thinking about this, the first place was that for many of us, and I think about my oldest daughter, who's 20 years old now, and we got her a checking account when she was in about 15, and she now has some investment accounts. She's never received a paper statement in her whole life, and she probably will never receive a paper statement in her whole life. And so this idea that what you should really do is probably once a year go up and print off a December 31st statement of all your accounts that you're paperless on, just so that somebody has a record of them. Because if you pass away, how would you even know to go look for those accounts if you didn't know they existed?
So, Kevin, Peter Barnes has been talking as we led up to this discussion about grandma having bitcoins.
Yep.
Have you run across that, grandmothers with bitcoins?
We see more and more people get looking at cryptocurrency as an asset class. I'm not necessarily sure I've seen grandma. We have a lot of Facebook grandmas where, there's that person in the family where the minute you're out at activity, you find your face up on Facebook because they had to take a photo and post it, but not necessarily Bitcoin.
Well, Barnes was on to something, as usual. Thank you, Kevin Ruth, head of wealth planning and personal trust.
Now we got to redo our wills, don't we?
Yeah.
I took notes on all this.
It's funny. And then there's this whole idea, too, Peter and Pat, about whether you keep, I was reading an article recently, whether you keep your loved ones' pages up.
Yeah, it's kind of creepy, isn't it?
It's creepy, but you know what? As we were sitting there talking, I looked up my dad's Facebook page. He passed away in 2011. And it was just kind of nice to look at these things. Members of the family made remarks on the page after he was gone.
Yeah.
It's just nice to go look this up, and you see some pictures here, and I don't know. That was kind of nice. I'm having a moment here, so. Anyways.
All right.
Coming up in this next hour, we're going to get to a lot of things, including Indigo, a unicorn startup focused on making the nation's food stores more resilient. They're right here in Boston. They're shifting now to America's cotton crop. We'll talk about the science and the numbers behind that. We'll talk to the CEO and the CIO, I believe. We'll have both of them here. And also, Ann Moss has been tracking news of local biotechs at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco all week. As the gathering winds down, she'll give us the highlights and what investors should watch for and the companies they ought to be watching. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore. So with us right now in our studio, Indigo CEO David Perry and Indigo co-founder and chief innovation officer Jeff Van Maltzen. Gentlemen, welcome to our program tonight. We are going to just a few basics. You guys are in Charlestown. In December, you raised an additional $47 million in Series D, and this after a $156 million round that granted the company the official status of unicorn. That was in late September. David, give us a quick overview of what you guys do and what, you know, what is your strategy here?
Sure. Thanks for having us on. So Indigo is focused on using microbiology to improve agriculture, specifically improve agricultural yields, make, you know, crops grow more, and to replace a lot of the chemicals that are used today. So chemical fertilizers, chemical insecticides, fungicides, that sort of thing.
So you're making seeds more resilient, stronger, better, faster?
Yeah, that's the idea is we think of ourselves as harnessing nature to help farmers feed the planet. And we focus really on three things: improving farm profitability, improving environmental sustainability, and then improving consumer health are the result of that from our crops.
So when you look long term, is it a goal or maybe not even a stated goal that one day we will not need fertilizer, we won't need pesticides, we won't need any of this stuff?
Yeah, it's frankly a stated goal. I can't tell you the time frame, but I think it's not an if, it's a when. And I could imagine that in 10 to 20 years we'll use less than half the fertilizer we use today, and maybe only 10% or so of the chemical insecticides and fungicides.
Let's bring Jeff into the conversation because he's the innovation off guy. So explain how this technology works. You do what with a microbe and what do you do with a seed? Explain it.
You just got it.
Is it gene editing or what is it? I mean, go ahead, explain it.
Let me actually start with biology that resides in us, i.e. in people. Mm-hmm. An explosive field over the course of the past 10 years has been the human microbiome. So that term describes the microbes that live in and on the human body. Mm-hmm. Every day we have trillions of microbes that are a part of us. And an apt description for the role that those microbes play in our health is that it's almost like a new human organ that we've really just had the tools to appreciate in the past several years. It affects our metabolism, our immune system.
It's like the good things in your gut.
Precisely.
Exactly.
The good guys.
Yeah.
And where we'd started the company, which was out of Flagship Pioneering, we've been investing.
Is this Nubar Afayan's group?
Precisely.
Yeah. Now, he was in here once. He talked about all that, the flora, which is the
exactly
stuff in your gut.
Precisely. Right? So microbiome is a more modern term for what people have called flora, et cetera, for a long period of time. So intuitively, this has been important for a very long time. But it's really become a tipping point of just totally new insight into people. So where did Indigo come from? It came from asking the question of, well, might there be a comparable relationship between microbes and plants? And it turns out that not only are plants surrounded by microbes in soil, if you take any plant in the world and cut it open, they're full of microbes on the inside. So every blade of grass in your lawn, every tree, every corn stalk in the world have microbes living inside of them. And via Indigo, we've discovered that those play an extraordinary role in the health, fitness, resilience, and performance of agricultural crops.
It sounds really exciting, but farmers have a way that they do things and they don't want to change necessarily. So how do you convince them?
So that's true. Farmers are normally thought to be conservative, but there's a few things working in our favor here. One is farmers are set up to experiment. They don't have to make all-or-nothing decisions.
That's
yeah,
right.
they can try it on a portion of their farm and see what happens. And we're in a farm economy where most farmers are struggling economically, so they're willing to try new things in order to try to improve their economic situation.
Let me connect a dot if I can here. So the microbes, when they're in our bodies, there's a chemical interaction.
Mm-hmm.
In the plant, same thing. You can is that what this is about at the end
That's
of the
right.
day? It's about chemistry, right? So you can change the microbes that are in the plant to change outcomes. Is that it?
Yeah, 100%. So if you think about it as to why that's taking place, think about a plant that lives in the desert. The microbes that get to live inside of that plant, they have an amazing home. I mean, you know, they could otherwise be sitting on a grate of sand cooked. Or if you get to reside inside of the plant, you're kept hydrated, you got sugar, you've got nutrients. And over evolutionary time, what that means is that those microbes are going to be motivated to figure out every way they can benefit plants possible. And so that's the power that we're tapping into.
No, but it's still not clear to me. Are you engineering these microbes or just getting more of them into one place or both?
We don't engineer anything. We're basically discovering microbes that exist already in the world, Microbes evolved over hundreds of millions of years to be to help plants deal with stress, as Jeff was describing. And a lot of those microbes have been eliminated by modern agricultural practices.
And this is David Perry, CEO of Indigo. So, David, take it a step further for us, your announcement on Indigo cotton. Tell us how what we've just been talking about applies to the cotton.
So increasingly consumers are interested in where their food and their clothing comes from. They want things produced in a way that's consistent with their health and with environmental sustainability. You know, the best example of this is the organic movement that continues to grow at multiple percentages a year. So what our microbes do is enable more sustainable farming by reducing the amount of water you need, reducing the amount of nitrogen, and other chemicals. So we sell the cotton we produce to garment manufacturers who are interested in producing clothing with more sustainable cotton, and in turn we pay farmers a premium for growing that
cotton.
Is it
better cotton?
It is better cotton.
Well, how? Is it whiter? Is it fluffier? Is it longer lasting?
Longer staple length, which is an important metric in cotton.
What's staple length?
It's the length of the fiber.
Oh.
So now that we understand kind of how it works, we want to know how the company works. You're a unicorn company. Congratulations. That's a big deal. So you must be doing something right. You're making money.
Well, thank you. We're not actually
well,
making
you're
money.
Well, you're valued. You're valued at a big amount of money.
We do intend to at some point.
The presumption is
That's
there.
That's always good.
If you're labeled unicorn, the presumption is there, right?
Yeah, the nice thing about working on agriculture is that it is an enormous industry, of course. We all eat. We're working on markets that are trillions of dollars. And if we can improve yields by 10%, that's enormous value creation.
Got to ask, are you guys microbiologists? Or did you grow up? Did somebody grow up on a farm here?
Yeah, I grew up.
You got to be a farmer.
I grew up on a farm in Arkansas, and I'm a chemical engineer. And Jeff?
I grew up in Texas.
But not farmer Jeff.
But regularly was visiting my grandfather's farm. Okay. And so I didn't expect I'd come back to think scientifically about agriculture, but I think it's near and dear to both of us.
So very good, gentlemen. He is Indigo CEO David Perry and Indigo co-founder and chief innovation officer Jeff Van Maltzen. Good to have you with us tonight. I will confess, as I did earlier, everything I tried to grow died. Well, there you go.
Yeah, we can help you out.
He can help you here. Get his card.
All right. Coming up all week long, Ann Mastu, our own Ann Mastu, has been tracking news of local biotechs at the J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference in San Francisco. As the annual gathering winds down today, Mastu gives us the highlights and the company's investors ought to be watching. And later on, yeah, we go to Vegas, baby. Tech conference, flying cars, and all kinds of other wonderful gadgets. Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business, Bloomberg 1061, Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
You're listening to Bloomberg Bay State Business with Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll on Bloomberg 1061, Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
All right, I'm Tom Maroney along with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll as we coast into a Friday night here. Later in the program, we'll check out that big tech show in Las Vegas. Peter has mentioned a couple of the items, but I saw this story too that I want to talk about. There's a flying car out there.
Huh? It was a big deal, big announcement.
I'd come to work in that. Anyway, as we wind down, the annual J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference took place this week in San Francisco. Winding down today, it's the biggest meeting of pharma giants, burgeoning biotechs, investors, researchers, healthcare execs. They're all out there, and that means lots of market-moving news and deals. It also comes with big-name keynote speeches, including a talk by Microsoft founder Bill Gates. Bloomberg's Ann Mastu reports.
In his opening keynote, Bill Gates talked about his support for life-saving research and reminded the biopharma industry of their role, including the business case for tackling diseases rampant in emerging economies.
What we need is more innovation, and of course that's why I'm here today. We've really accelerated the introduction of vaccines.
Gates pointed out that current medical technologies being tested in fields like cancer immunotherapy may be effective against HIV/AIDS and malaria. Gates is backing companies like Moderna in Cambridge on messenger RNA approaches for vaccine and drug development. Bloomberg's Caroline Chen was reporting from the conference all this week, and she says the tone was more upbeat than last year.
In contrast to last year, where as the conference was happening, President Trump was quoted on TV saying, pharma are murderers. And that sort of set this tone of huge uncertainty. What would the Trump administration do in 2017? And there just wasn't any of that sort of major news rocking the conference this year.
That's in part because most biotech and pharma companies are happy about tax reform.
Tax reform was, I would say, the biggest topic that was discussed, but there's a bit of a wait-and-see quality to it because tax reform obviously was only very recently passed. We heard a lot of big pharma companies say that they are really happy about it. They think it's good for the industry. It means a lot of money currently offshore could be repatriated back to the U.S. at a better tax rate. But then the question from the biotech side is, so what is big pharma going to do with this money? Or what is big biotech going to do with this money? Does this lead to more M&A? That's what they hope. Or are they just going to do share buybacks? We'll have to see what happens in the latter half of this year.
But there were deal announcements. Takeda announced it will buy Tygenix to add a stem cell therapy for Crohn's disease to its pipeline. Celgene announced it would spend up to $7 billion to acquire Impact Biomedicines. And Novo Nordisk, the world's biggest insulin maker, bid $3.1 billion for a Belgian biotech firm. But it's not all good news.
More bad news for Alzheimer's, unfortunately. Pfizer said it was cutting back on its R&D group in Alzheimer's, and another small biotech Axovent that had a data readout said that its drug didn't work in a key trial. And so who does that leave? That leaves Boston's big company, Biogen. Biogen is now, I think, the only company that has a drug in phase 3 trials, the final stage. So I think there'll be all eyes on Biogen in the Alzheimer's space. They're not going to have results until, I think, 2019 on that big trial. But, you know, everybody's always wondering whether they're going to give a little bit of data in the interim.
Also among Boston and Cambridge market movers this week, Boston Scientific was up after saying it aims to launch the Lotus heart valve in the U.S. and EU in 2019. Bioverativ of Waltham was up after announcing 2017 preliminary revenue growth of 31% to 32%. This ahead of estimates for $1.1 billion or 30% growth. Bioverativ was spun off from Biogen and it's poised for near-term growth with its long-term treatments for hemophilia A and B. And Agios Pharmaceuticals of Cambridge was up after its first partner drug launch, shows revenue, and the company says it's on track to make its wholly owned U.S. launch in 2018. Again, here's Bloomberg's Caroline Chen.
Sage Therapeutics had some really impressive data on postpartum depression drug last year, and they're going to be moving forward with that, trying to get that to market this year. The other very hot area is CAR-T cancer treatments. These are personalized cell therapies for blood cancers. And there are a number of companies working on them, including Bluebird Bio, which is a Boston company. And they're all just trying to get their treatments out onto the market. And that's a very, very exciting space still.
And Caroline says the overall conference really set the tone for the year ahead in biotech and pharma. You can read more news from the annual event on the terminal and on Bloomberg.com. I'm Ann Mostu, Bloomberg 1061, Boston, Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West in the South Shore.
All right. Well, you know, it's a much different take this year than the last because there's a lot of volatility in biotech, and that seems to have calmed down a bit, Peter Brown.
Well, the thing that is very tough is this Alzheimer's space. Biogen is basically the last man standing among these biotech companies that is a big company pouring tons of money into this, but it's really hard science. My mom passed from Alzheimer's, so I know a little bit about this, and I learned in that whole process as we were looking for treatments and help for her that the science was, you know, 10 years out at a minimum to before we
they're
get
in a phase
real
three
therapies
with something.
Biogen?
That's what the report said.
Okay. Good to know.
Good to know.
Phase three is, means big population tests. But Biogen, yes, has been doing good work in this area. Thank you, Tom.
Very good. All right. So next, we'll have a little fun. We're going to talk to an eyewitness. But maybe that's the wrong word. Maybe a guy who was out at the Las Vegas Tech Conference. That's better. He will be our eyes and ears about flying cars, quantum computing. And Peter, what's this device I've been hearing about? It really folds your laundry?
Laundry
are you
folding?
Making that
a
up?
Robot.
It isn't.
Uses artificial intelligence to fold and sort your laundry.
But then there's a wine gizmo that you're going to want to hear.
What's more about the gizmo coming up?
Okay.
All right, I'm Tom Maroney, Peter Barnes, and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West on the South Shore.
The Bruins and Celtics are both off. The Patriots, of course, play the Titans tomorrow night. Peter and Tom.
The Titans.
All right.
Do we have any Titans fans out there? I didn't think so.
All right. it's going to be an interesting game.
I like it when they really croak people. You know, other people said, I want it to be close and exciting. I don't. I like it when it's 45 to nothing. Well, that's just me.
Well, you can watch it on your latest gizmo from the Consumer Electronics Show out in Vegas, which wrapped today. Plenty of Boston companies attending to show off all their latest gadgets and technologies. Tom Maroney whipped out his credit card for the $16,000 robot that uses artificial intelligence to sort and fold laundry. Ramon Lamas is a research manager for devices and displays at IDC in Framingham, and he's just back from the show. He joins us now by phone for more. And Ramon, gotta ask a tech guy, what blew your socks off this year at the show?
Oh man,
was there a device that blows your socks off? I mean, no. Like literally, if there's one that does laundry,
they'll make
right.
You know, if you look hard enough, I'm sure you could find something that could do that. Because, you know, this is a showcase where, you know, you can pick up any object you want and they'll make it smart for you and they're going to try to market it. But for me, it was really everything going on in South Hall, and that's really where all the robotics were taking place. That's where all the drones were taking place. Saw some of the augmented reality and some of the virtual reality devices there. The stuff that could blow your mind. I mean, if you think back to, you know, what we thought what science fiction would be and how, you know, the 21st century would be, with, say, like, you know, the Jetsons and Buck Rogers. You know, and those things seem so far-fetched way back then. But now they have robots that can, you know, run security for your house or play your multimedia, act as a companion for the elderly or for a baby or anything like that. And so to think that we've come so far so fast that we can have machines substituting for humans to do, you know, all sorts of chores. I think that was the most mind-blowing set of a products that I saw on the show floor.
Well, you know, I don't want to throw cold water on everybody's party here, but let me ask this question, Ramon, because we've been talking about that. You know, Peter's wine opener, I've seen some other things, maybe not necessarily at the tech show, but I've come up with a category called gratuitous technology. Did you see things in Las Vegas where you thought, you know, do we really need this?
Aha. And that is, you know, one of the hang-ups that we have about CES. Because if you take a look at everything that's there and put it into a huge box, you're lucky if, you know, 20% of those objects and products make it out of that box and into the marketplace. A lot of the devices that we see there, they're really just prototypes or concepts. You know, they'll give you a vague timeline saying, oh, this will come out later on this year, but we still got a lot of tweaks to it. So, you know, while they're just really using that space to, you know, flex their innovation muscles and just want to give you an idea as to what they're going to do.
And a show off. And a show off.
Yeah. And it's fun.
And show off. You know, absolutely. Go ahead. But, you know, is this real? Are all these things probably going to make it to prime time?
So can you give us a couple of things that you think will really make it?
Well, you know, I think some robotics are going to make it there. I mean, the companion ones are probably among the most popular ones because, you know, they're actually fulfilling some sorts of needs.
For example,
you know, if you have an aged parent. Let's say you know your mother passed away and your father's all by himself. Now you have a robot that could, you know, spend time with him, remind him to say, here, you know, it's time to get up and go and move around. Or, you know, you have an incoming message from your family. Would you like to send the response back and guide him through the process of, you know, sending pictures and videos and have conversations, you know, back and forth. So it's that kind of, you know, some companionship that you know, that some people were trying to, you know, present there.
You're not talking about, you know, something from a science fiction movie at this point. You're talking what about a device that's on a table that, you know, looks like a box or an Alexa or you know, a speaker or what are you talking about?
You know,
what is this
thing?
How
about it's all of the above. It's all of the above. Some of these things are, you know, small desktop type items, no bigger than a lamp. But you know, they have faces that light up and that they emote and they, you know, have moving, screen, looks like a face that you're interacting with. Meanwhile, one of the other more popular devices over there were robots that would monitor your house while you're gone, and they'd actually, get up, walk around outside, and take pictures and monitor with video and stuff like that.
Ramon, you come home from vacation one time, and the robot has locked you out. Correct.
Well, I'm not saying that these things are perfect. In fact, far from it. As a matter of fact, it wasn't too long ago that our friends out there in Redmond, Washington, Microsoft, they had some robots acting as security for the campus, which I think is a great idea. But guess where one of those robots ended up? Upended in the fountain.
Ooh.
And could not get out.
Huh.
That must
Ouch.
Have been a good
so
night.
What about the flying cars?
The
Volocopter, and Tom wants one that goes on the land and in the water.
He wants to be able to land, go water, and air. Do they have that yet, Ramon?
Land, water, and air. I think we're still a couple cycles away from that, but really, the main thing here is
so diplomatic.
Judging on what I've seen, if you have a car that, we always talk about these driverless cars. Now, how would you like to climb into a vehicle roughly the size of a VW minivan, and the interior is well appointed, kind of like a nice living room, and there's big screens over there, and it's quite comfortable. There's not a single accelerator or steering wheel. It's like a portable living room that'll take you from point A to point B in quiet comfort as you want.
Ramon, I got to get before we lose you. What would you whip your credit card out for that you saw at the show that you could afford or not? What is the one thing that you would actually buy that you saw at the show?
Really quick and simple. I really like the virtual reality devices that I saw from this company called HTC, their next iteration of what they call the Vive Pro. It's a headset that you put on and transforms the, you don't see your physical area around you. You're transported to an entire virtual world. Mm-hmm. Use it for gaming, entertainment. You could also use it for work and productivity.
Well, Ramon, you know better than we that VR has had some, has stumbled or has really not picked up as people thought. So you're seeing this new generation as promising then.
It's promising. The resolution's better, and what I like to call the vomit factor, because a lot of these initial introductions of
or the VF.
Reality in the past, yeah, it got a lot of people sick.
Motion sickness.
But now the technology has come so far, the alignment between sound and visual and moving things around, much sharper now. And so,
well, Ramon Lamas, research manager wearables and mobile phones at IDC in Framingham, we appreciate this, and we're glad you're not the one who ended up in the fountain upside down. So appreciate the insights from Las Vegas. All right, coming up on our show next week, straight from Justin Trudeau's cabinet, a Canadian minister will join us on NAFTA and how it will help Canada and Boston. And we'll also have our real estate guru, Aaron Jodka, in to talk about Seaport Square. I find it one of the most interesting, if not the most interesting, development on the books in the city of Boston as we speak. Everybody, a nice weekend. Go Pats. I'm Tom Maroney with Peter Barnes and Pat Carroll. It's Bay State Business, Bloomberg 1061, Boston Newburyport, and 1330 Metro West and the South Shore.